This is Tuan from Sacramento. I'm a delegate for the HEB Capital Chapter.
Anthony Signorello, alternate delegate from the Glendale Burbank Chapter.
Hello, and I'm Charles Dickens from Sacramento.
John Ross, treasurer, Rural Revival League of California, and I'll be walking around later on collecting dues for the Rural Challenge, so I hope you can give as much as you can, and any amount is appreciated. Thank you.
Penny Valdivinos, I'm the president of the Greater Bakersfield Chapter.
Diane Deutsch, delegate from the Greater Bakersfield Council of the Blind.
Dan Kaiser from the Capital Chapter of CCB.
Preston Moses from the Alameda Chapter and Bayview as well of CCB.
Pam Lepland, member of CCB at large, an avid reader of anything, Braille, talking book, digital, I don't care.
Enjoy it all, huh?
Yeah. I'm Linda Amate, and I'm a great fan of the new BARD system and a good fan of the Victor Reader that I just received not too long ago. So I'm happily wearing that out.
Thank you, Linda.
David Hoffman from the Silicon Valley Chapter, and thanks to Talking Books. I've read more books over the last 2 years than 10 years cited. So, thank you.
Yes.
Here we go.
Oh, I'm Risa Gibson. I'm a member of the Alameda County CCB and Bayview chapters.
This is Susan Hyatt, and I am from the Silicon Valley Council of the Blind, and I live in San Jose.
Rob Turner, Silicon Valley.
Alice McGrath, Silicon Valley.
Thank you.
Andrea Pitzenbarger from Orange County.
Beautiful place to from.
Diane Phelps from Solano County Chapter.
Josie Conkling from Capital Chapter.
Evelyn Drury from the San Diego area.
And another Diane Phelps. I'm from Napa, California, and we don't have a chapter at this point, but so I'm a member at large.
Farrell Brown, Redwood Empire, and also a member of San Francisco.
Good afternoon. This is David Jackson from San Francisco Chapter.
Ann Kaiser, new secretary of CULA and member of the Capital Chapter.
Jerry Arakawa, past president of CULA and member of Greater LA Chapter.
I'm Doug Martin from the San Diego chapter, and I have Seymour, a one-year-old white cane from Revolutionary Enterprises.
Nancy Shaw, Redwood Empire.
Clarence LaBarre, Chicago, Illinois.
Art Lake, Lake Traffic Solutions, Walnut Creek.
Yeah, Keith Johnson, Pasadena, California, and vice president of the BRLC. Second Vice President Glendale Burbank Area Chapter. And that's all I got to say.
I'm Karen Smith from the Alameda County OCB.
Michelle Singleton, El Dorado Hills, California.
Hello, everyone. For the sake of this meeting, I will identify myself as Linda Porrell, San Francisco Chapter President. member of the BRLC Board of Directors, and promise to join Kahlua as well.
We heard that.
Frank. Frank Welty, Vice President of the San Francisco Chapter and Lame Duck Director of Advocacy and Governmental Affairs for CCB.
I'm Peter Pardini, Treasurer of Library Users of California, also Treasurer of the California Council of the Blind, a member of the San Francisco Chapter.
Hello.
Where's the mic? I'm Connie Bateman, and I'm board member of Capital Chapter, and I'm also board member of Kahlua, and I'm also on the Education Committee.
There you go.
I'm Ron Bateman from Sacramento, California.
And I'm Veronica DeMarie from the Redwood Empire in Santa Rosa, and also the San Francisco area.
Great.
Ta-da.
Was that Gigi who did that?
Yes.
Thank you so much, Gigi. Okay, everyone. We've come to that time in the meeting where we're going to have our speaker, Mike Marlin. Can I have your attention? I know we need to be getting on with lunch, but we want to do it quietly. I was really pleased when Mike Marlin, who's the director of the Talking Book and Braille, or Braille and Talking Book Library here in Sacramento, said that he would speak to us today. So, and he's got lots to tell us. So here he is. Welcome, Mike Marlin.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, well, thank you, Judy. Thanks for inviting me. Thanks for you all. Thanks to CCB and for Kahlua. Well, I think it's a great acronym, even if you do change your name. I think you should toast every meeting with Kahlua. Anyhow, so Judy, thank you for inviting me and several of folks in the room I know and I've interacted with in my tenure for the last 4 years, but I'm always delighted to meet new folks as well. So I'm going to stick around for part of the afternoon afterwards and check out the exhibits and, you know, shirk my work responsibilities as much as I can. And I hope that Valerie, who's my Valerie Reese Lerman, who's a reader advisor, is also here. And I hope that she won't tell on me. Okay. Anyhow, Judy asked me to talk about my experience as a blind librarian, and but I also have a lot of good information about the about our program, about trends, what NLS is doing, what the future of the National Library Service and general, you know, reading availability of various reading coalitions and all that stuff, and what's out there, and of course, time for questions is if you have any, that will be great. So first of all, a little bit about me, and I always get a little self-conscious talking about myself, but I'll try not to. So I was born with retinitis pigmentosa, but I didn't really know it until I got an official diagnosis at 21. I had a lot of interesting escapades driving a car before then, and from driving into a tunnel where it's very bright to it being very dark and not knowing where I was, and praying and getting through to the other side where I could see again, because my eyes hadn't adjusted to the light. And that I stopped driving shortly after that, thank goodness. And other problems I was having with reading, et cetera, I won't bore you with all the details. But I basically went to Brown University, got a degree in communications, and wanted to go into public broadcasting. And I did that for many years. As my sight gradually declined, I found it was harder and harder to work the broadcasting equipment, especially with the digital revolution that started in the 80s and the engineering problems that ensued for me. I was a production director and a music director, and so I would engineer live remote broadcasts, engineer the NPR's feeds, all that kind of stuff. Play music. I'm a big jazz fan, so I had a jazz show, and produce radio theater, and public service announcements and all that stuff. Did that for many years here in California at Santa Cruz at KUSP, and also for a station in Alaska. And that was a really interesting experience. And then I ended up in Seattle. Couldn't find a radio job except for the 3 to 6 a.m. board shift at the public radio station. And seeing as how I was gradually losing sight, I thought it's time to change careers. So I went to library school. And I'd always been a huge fan of libraries ever since I was a kid growing up in D.C., Washington, D.C., where I would spend a lot of time in the public libraries, but also the Georgetown University, American University libraries, doing research for high school. So, oh, and the other thing I did, the most fun library thing I did, was cataloging jazz records at the Pacifica radio affiliate in Washington, D.C., KPFA. The WPFW. And that was, if any experience broadened my horizons of life, the universe, and culture and everything, it was that. And that's kind of what got me into broadcasting. So, anyhow, fast forwarding back to working, getting a degree in librarianship, doing my assignments with my face, 2 inches from the paper, and still reading, but having more difficulty. And then I went into and started a library career, worked at a National Park Service Library in Seattle, Environmental Protection Agency Library, then wound up working at an engineering consultant, and that's when I got introduced to assistive technology and reached out to the Voc Rehab Blind Services in Seattle and started learning about all this stuff that I didn't know was out there. And then learned Braille in 2000 and subsequently worked for the Talking Book and Braille Library in Seattle with a temporary position. Then got an offer from Tucson Pima Public Library in Arizona. And, I should say I worked for the Department of Voc Rehab as a counselor for a couple of years as well. And the interesting thing about this and what made me even more involved in advocacy, because I'd been an NFB and WCB, Washington Council of the Blind, member in Seattle, because I worked in the Talking Book Library there, and I met lots of great people, learned about advocacy of both consumer groups and how important that was. Got to Tucson, and I told them about the accommodation I needed, and they said, "Really? We didn't know you needed any accommodation." Now, granted, I'd walked into the interview with a cane and told them about how I had adapted various things on the job, including brailing my files and this and that. And then I get there, and they said, "Oh, well, we don't think we can give you the position that we hired you for," which was as a reference librarian. And they got involved. They did a site assessment, and they made the determination that it was beyond reasonable accommodation to outfit me to work at a public desk. Needless to say, I was not pleased with this. They offered me an outreach position, which I took because I'd moved down there. What was I going to do? And one of the big reasons was that the integrated library system, which is called Millennium, which is III Innovative Interface something or other, which is out of Emeryville, California. And I'm not trying to, there are some great people who work there, and I don't want to disparage that company. But I think it goes into the larger trend of accessibility and accommodation, in the workforce, generally speaking, and in librarianship, the fact that these systems started out with DOS, if anyone here remembers DOS. And that was accessible because it was a text-based interface. Well, then JavaScripting came along, and these systems started getting more and more sophisticated with more and more frames on the screen and more drop-down flash applications, etc. And they basically became non-accessible for screen readers and also, I've heard, screen magnifiers. So, and the company, of course, said that they would love to help the library out, but they couldn't put the investment into development for just one person. So anyway, that's a little story. It definitely helped me see the need for advocacy on a national scale. And I took that experience. Luckily, I was ended up hearing about the position out here and coming to California, which is wonderful to stay on the West Coast, and head the library here. But one of the other things I did as far as advocacy and self-advocacy was get involved with the American Library Association. And I was actually just elected to the ALA Council, which is their governing body, which makes all the decisions about the association. And, you know, primarily because the people within the Association for State and Cooperative Library Agencies wanted to have a representative who could talk about accessibility. And one of the things we did within the past few years was draft and have passed two resolutions, one calling for strongly urging libraries to purchase electronic material and databases only if they're accessible from vendors, and that they have to meet Section 504 and 508 standards as well as W3C standards. And it was interesting to hear some of the arguments against it from some of the council members, but by and large that passed, and that's been helpful. We created an accessibility toolkit for the association called Think Accessible, and many librarians have communicated with us and told us how helpful it's been for the types of questions that they need to ask vendors, and when they should complain when vendors say one thing and provide something else, which does happen. And the other resolution we were able to get passed was a web accessibility, so that all libraries should have accessible websites. And that passed with flying colors. You know, we're at an advantage here because this state has additional laws that really promote accessibility and accommodation, adaptive technology. And I know that there's been some movement in the university systems to make things more accessible. We still have a long way to go, but we're getting there, and I hope to be able to continue to advocate within the National Association. So, being a screen reader and braille reader and all that great stuff that comes with assistive technology, there are still barriers. I'm sure anyone out here who's been employed knows what those are, and they manifest differently for each of us in our different types of professions. But I find more and more that people are more interested and more willing to accept that changes need to be made. And if you know, if you've ever worked for the state of California or any state government, you know that many of their systems were designed back in the Mesozoic period. And simple things like setting, entering data about an out-of-state conference you have to go to, that software is totally inaccessible. So that's just an example, something that we've been working on. Tim Ford, who some of you may know, has also been working on those kinds of issues. But enough about me. Now you all talk about me. Seriously. I'm not sure how best to do this, but I do have some statistics I was going to run by you real quick. And let me just set up here with Mr. Stream just a second. Yeah, I was going to talk about the library, but one thing I thought people might want to know, for any number crunchers in the audience who are interested in statistics, that I'll preface that by saying that for those of you who don't know, the Braille and Talking Book Library, the Braille and Talking Book Library is the regional library for Northern California for the National Library Service for the blind and physically handicapped. And just for anyone who's wondering about the use of the word handicapped, although it's not in vogue, it takes an act of Congress to change the name of an agency. And that's why it hasn't happened yet. I imagine it will one of these days. Anyway, we're the regional library for Northern California. We have two sub-regional libraries, one in Fresno, one in San Francisco. They only lend talking books, but we provide Braille to all of their patrons as well. And in Southern California, the Braille Institute serves library users down there. We're one of the three or four states, well, actually I think there are more, that have two regional libraries. It's, you know, generally in large geographical regions, that's the case. New York State, for example, California, Pennsylvania happens to have two regional libraries. Ohio used to. That's one model. And then there's places like Florida and Georgia where they have one regional library and then 10 or 11 sub-regional libraries, which are usually housed in public libraries so that they have a sub-regional library. There are other types of special needs. I hate to use that word, but that's what they go by. Sections of public libraries, and I'll talk about that a little bit later when I'm talking about other opportunities for readers who are vision impaired or physically disabled. So anyway, so let's talk about us. We have 12,000 individual patrons registered. We have 552 institutions registered. We know that the eligible population in Northern California is probably four times that at least. That's generally the formula that's used in determining eligible legally blind people. So advocacy is certainly something that we're thinking about all the time, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. But let me run off these other statistics. Let's see. Okay, so in April, just talking about the last month, 583 Braille books were distributed to 800, and not all of them, but we have 830 registered Braille patrons. And let's see, going on here. Within the past 12 months, 6,649 Braille items were distributed. It comes to an average of about 7 Braille items per year, per person. 7.2. Let's see, moving on here. And I apologize for not having a Braille copy to work with, but as I said, we ran out of Braille paper. We have 8,177 people signed up for the digital books program out of our 12,000, so we're about 72% of the way there. That's after a year and a half. We have 85 institutions. We're working on getting our institutions signed up because we really, people have commented on how easy to use the new digital talking book machine is and the sound quality and all that. And I think that it will also help us to get a lot of our younger readers back into the fold who may have been nonplussed with the cassette machine and some of the uncoolness about it, to borrow a phrase. We have 9,096 cassette patrons and 463 institutions signed up for cassette players. Now, BARD, of course, the Braille and audio reading download, and I encourage all of you who use computers or know somebody who has one to subscribe to the BARD service. It's free. There are 21,000 or so digital books available for download. Something like 50 magazines that come out, either weekly or monthly or bi-monthly. And we have 1,626 people subscribed to BARD, which is pretty good. That's a little less than 10% of the readership. At least 559 of those people downloaded at least one book in April. Out of the 1,626 patrons, 6,370 books were downloaded and 247 magazines were downloaded in April. Since the NLS, National Library Service fiscal year began in October, 42,000 books have been downloaded, magazines have been downloaded. However, in the previous fiscal year for NLS, the entire year, 41,000. So we've already surpassed the previous year with 5 months to go in this calendar year for NLS. So BARD is on the rise, and you can download a book in your pajamas. I mean, who could beat that? (Laughter) In April, we circulated 18,000 plus digital books, 6,300 Bard books, as I said, and 3,800 cassette books. So, wait, is that right? Let me see here. Yeah. No. 24,000, I'm sorry, 24,000. 18,000 dBs, 24,000 cassettes. If you add Bard in there, it's about 50-50 as far as the distribution goes. And this is average for most of the nation. I'm sure it will change over time, but of course, one of the things about the digital program is because it hasn't been around as long, there are fewer titles to select. So there are about 5,100 digital books on cartridge that have been produced so far, and 57,000, I think, cassette books, and then another 14,000-15,000 books that were on long playing, 33, 16, and 70 RPM. We have retired our collection because the usage is basically, you know, that we have one or two people with the old record player who still request books, but that's about it. And we have some, if you ever are in our neck of the woods, come by, we can show you one of the old ones. You had to change the stylus yourself with every book that you listen to. Let's see, now, and then I'm just going to give you a final set of statistics here. We circulated over 500,000 books last year in within a 12-month period. It works out to about used to be about 3,000 items a day going out the door and about the same coming in that our circulation department has to handle. However, with the advent of digital, it's gone down a little bit. And part of that reason is because we started off with a limit of 4 digital books per person. And I'm proud to announce that the limit has been removed entirely. So if you are interested in digital books.
Yeah. Oh, that's all? Oh, my goodness.
Like I say, I have way too much to talk about. We generally have a 25 book maximum on all formats. So you can come up with a combination of 18 and 7 or 10 and 15 or 20 and 5 or whatever. We do sort of include Braille books, but most people don't usually want to receive more than one or two at a time. Some people do more. And I was going to say that we have 5,100 digital, I said that, okay. And 1,200,000 something copies of cassette books in our basement. So we're working on weeding that collection now that more of them are becoming available, especially on digital format. So sorry to bore you with all those statistics, but hopefully somebody found them interesting. And there's a lot of things to talk about. Again, let me just talk briefly, allude to what Judy had mentioned in terms of the budget and how that may or may not affect the library. Back in March, the governor had proposed eliminating some key public assistance library programs and entirely. And if that had happened, there was a good chance it would jeopardize our federal funding from the library, the LSTA, the Library Service Technology Act. Luckily, the assembly voted to pass minor cuts to those programs, and we had to maintain a level of funding that would ensure that federal matching money. The two groups came together and compromised and cut the library assistance program from something like $30 million down to $13 million. Which is going to affect literacy programs, unfortunately. But it means that if this passes, and I say if, because the final budget has not come out yet, and there's a May revise on Monday, and we don't know what's going to be in it. So we're not out of the woods yet, but I do want to thank all the CCB members who came to the Capitol and testified at hearings. It was very moving testimony, and I think it had a lot to do with swaying that committee to propose very minor cuts. Our state librarian did testify to the Senate, which was a closed hearing, and so that was good. So, and I guess all this dovetails into the need for advocacy, which As some of you have known, there was a period within the library where we had three reader advisors retire, and we only had a couple of people to answer the phones. And we had to put this horrible message on our machines that due to library staffing, it may take us 5 to 10 business days to get back to you. And I cringed when we put that in there, but we had to be fair and be honest to folks. I'm happy to say we've hired two new reader advisors, Lakeisha, who used to be our receptionist, as well as Laura, who's a new reader advisor, and Valerie, who retired but came back as a half-time retired annuitant. She's still with us, thankfully. So we should be okay about our return, our time for returning calls. And, of course, we respond to email as well. What I'm doing is, this year, is putting together bylaws for a patron advisory council. And I'm going to be reaching out to CCB, NFB, Blinded Veterans, Lighthouse, all kinds of people, because one of the things about an advisory council is to have representation geographically, age-wise, as well as disability-wise. So, and that will include physical disability as well as neurological disability, as well as a parent, or either a juvenile or the parent of a juvenile, to represent that facet of the readership. So you'll be hearing more from me through your organization's leaders, and I haven't figured out exactly how we're going to do this yet. One of the things we're constrained by is money, sorry to say. I think we're able to handle one in-person meeting at the library each year and bring people and put them up in a hotel for a night and have a nice meeting. But the rest of it, whether it's two or three more times a year, will have to be done either by chat, accessible chat software, or teleconference, or whatever format makes sense to people. Let's see. The other thing I wanted to mention real quick, sort of an announcement, is that Pauline Grenbo, who's been a volunteer at the library, has gotten involved with the California Center for the Book, which is down at UCLA. And they are piloting a program this summer called Hearing Voices. And Pauline is a huge audiobook advocate, and she wanted to make sure that blind and low vision readers were included in this as well. So they've identified, I think, 4 books, and they're all books that we have available either physically or for download. They are going to be using the commercial audio versions of these books, and they have playaways, and they're also going to have the books available through OverDrive, which is the download from the public library, as well as compact disc, so CDs. And, you know, those aren't necessarily heavily accessible, but they are usable. I'm sure some of you folks have used CDs for audiobooks. And I didn't bring the information with me, but please contact me. The first meeting is going to be on June 5th. They're going to have the commercial narrator from the Stieg Larsson, Girl with a Dragon Tattoo book. He lives in the Bay Area. I don't remember his name, but he'll be there. And then they'll be discussing like The Maltese Falcon, The Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton. I forget what the other book is. There's 4 other books. I believe it's every 3 weeks or something starting June 5th at the Arden Dimmick branch of the Sacramento Public Library. So if you're interested, contact the library or contact me. I have a lot of information stored in this noggin, and but let me stop for a few minutes and see if people have any questions that we can answer. Funny that you asked that. He's asking, we can give you an idea of how many people download Web Braille, and the answer is no, and I mentioned this in the last group. The problem is that the NLS rolled out Web Braille in the mid-90s, before the internet, before integrated library system databases were available. So they've never been able to really track statistics other than how many people are signed up. When Braille moves to BARD, which will be happening, I think, before the end of this year. It's their next top priority. Then we'll be able to maintain all those statistics and see what electronic Braille books people are downloading and all those statistics.
I have a question. Thank you. Oh, we do have a microphone. Thank you. Yeah, this is Doug Martin. I'm just wanting to know, given that we obviously are facing huge budget cuts, federal and state, why was it necessary to design a totally new type of cartridge rather than just putting encrypted files on a compact flash card or an SD card?
Mm-hmm. Right. Why did the National Library Service go to flash memory? Is that what you mean?
Why did they design their
for the cartridges?
Special cartridges?
Oh, okay. Well, what was out there at the time, and I can't answer speak completely for NLS, but I will bring this question back to them. That it was they had to develop something, given digital mastering capability that began back in the early 2000s, and they went through a whole development process. Because the other main option at that point was compact discs. And those are not really, they don't lend themselves as suitable for massive mail handling. I mean, if you're a Netflix subscriber, every other disc is damaged. The British Royal Library for the Blind, they do. They send you a compact disc, but you get to keep it, which is what they would have had to do. I know that's not a really good answer. Right.
Can I make a quick comment, Rob Turner?
Sure.
There you go, Rob.
The only reason I know this is because I participated in the beta of this, and the reason they went to the cartridges as opposed to a thumb drive or SD card or any of that other stuff was for the ability for the elderly and the physically handicapped who do not have the dexterity that maybe we do, and
right.
So they wanted to be easy to take in,
right,
to put in and pull out.
I was about to say that too, but thank you, Rob. Yeah, I mean, the ease of access of picking up a cartridge that wasn't too different in size from the cassette, and for people who have all kinds of mobility issues and dexterity issues, age-related issues, they developed a download site so that people can get utilize their own SD cards and flash drives and whatnot. Plus, the new digital player will accommodate a thumb drive, which is something. And I know that they are talking about capability for down the road, and New Zealand is in the process of testing this, but a way for Wi-Fi machines to have selections pushed out to those machines virtually through the ether, and then you get your book right on your player there, and you don't have to handle anything. We're a little bit of a ways from that. Also, before the next question, real quick, since someone mentioned iPhones earlier, the NLS is contracted with the Droid, and soon NLS books will be downloadable for the Droid, and I'm sure that the iPhone will be coming down the road so that can play NLS books on there as well. I don't know I think you'll still have to download them from your computer, but I could be wrong. What do I know? I'm an old guy, too.
So. Hi, Mike. this is Jerry Arakawa. I wanted to know what how the digital restoration program is going through with Bard. I know, as a Bard user, I bet I am in good company. Every Friday, I look eagerly to see what new things are downloaded. Mm-hmm. And I saw fairly recently that Study in Scarlet, one of the first books read by Alexander Scorby, was digitally restored. And I wondered if you could tell us how that is going with all their priorities.
Yeah, and that's one of the old TBs, which are one of the old LPs that was converted. That was sort of a pilot to see how it worked. It's gotten lots of acclaim. So they are going to go back and retrospectively digitize a lot of those popular books that were only available on LP. Just so you know, the plan, NLS's plan, is to digitize every single RC as well. And that's going to happen in the next several years as resources are available. Let's see, does that answer that question? Last thing to say about that is that the focus right now is on series to try to fill in the gaps so that you don't have to read series on two different formats, which is a pain in the you-know-what, and we're all aware of that. So I think within the next couple of years, that will be the first priority, to digitize books and series so that they're all available. And that way you can download them all to one device. We also have purchased some blank cartridges, and we hope within the next year or two to be able to start either providing duplication on demand service, although we're going to need to increase the staff for that. But more likely, we will put full series on books and make them available as part of our regular circulation. So that's the plan.
One more question. Where is it? Okay.
And I'll be available afterwards, too.
I'm going to sneak in two questions. A local question and a national question. Local question is, I know the San Francisco Library kind of goes its own way, kind of a little bit. But why was I told after a year that because I hadn't borrowed a book from the library, that I did all my downloading from Bard, that I was no longer considered active?
Okay.
So that's question number one. Right. National question, when a book, when a really hot book, you look on the site and you see that it's in process, why can't they give us some kind of date that it might be available by?
Valerie, can you write that one, last second one for me? I need to ask NLS about that. Let's see, your first question, we have in our database, which is a great database, but it's quirky. It's built on an older platform and they keep adding to it. So one of the features in there is due for service, which means someone hasn't borrowed something. Well, we tried to circumvent that by adding a code for download only, and that's supposed to prevent people from getting those letters. Obviously, it didn't work in this case, and I need to go back and investigate that. Yeah. And the second question again. What was your second question?
Second question was when a book
in
process,
yeah.
Can they give us some kind of deadline as to when it might be available?
My guess is that they'll probably say no, but I will ask them, because it goes to a producer, and the producer has live narrators that get sick sometimes or quit or... do they put those in process? Okay. Well, those don't take nearly as long. But I don't know. I mean, because it's just a conversion process, so it's not a live narrator. I will ask about that. That's a great question. Anyone else? The pooch over in the corner, did you have a question? He wanted to know how come there's no downloadable dog biscuits available. We'll get back to you on that. Thank you all. Thank you all. Please stay in touch with us. There's business cards up here along with Braille documents. I can give you my personal card if you need it. I didn't get to talk about the digital talking book machine that got shot in Texas. It was in someone's mailbox, and someone put a bullet through it. They had it on the operating table, and its last words were, "player off," or something like that. But, no, it's actually a true story, except for the last bit. And Steve mentioned earlier about someone tipping a mailbox over by putting too much Braille in it. There was also a bomb scare here in Sacramento a few years ago with someone left a carton of Braille on top of a mailbox. So be careful with those Braille books. And again, thank you very much. It was a delight to be here.